Welcome to this edition of the Northwestern Law Review Online's podcast. Today, we're talking with Duke Law Professor Joseph Blocher, who recently published with us a piece titled Death Penalty and the Fifth Amendment. The piece looks in depth at a specific argument often made by proponents of the death penalty, arguing that the Constitution specifically contemplates the death penalty, therefore immunizing it from challenge under the Eighth Amendment. Today, we're going to talk with Professor Blocher about his piece, how it fits into the broader context of Fifth and Eighth Amendment thinking, and where he thinks capital punishment jurisprudence might go from here. Professor Blocher, welcome.
Thank you so much for having me on, Matt.
I'd like to start with a question geared toward people who might listen to this podcast but not read your article. So what exactly is the Fifth Amendment argument, and why are we discussing this at all?
Well, it comes in a few different forms, but the basic thrust of the Fifth Amendment argument is that the text of the Fifth Amendment insulates capital punishment against constitutional challenge. So just as a real quick refresher, the text of the Fifth Amendment refers three times to capital punishment. It says that no person shall be held to answer for a capital crime unless on presentment or indictment of a grand jury. So there's one reference. Nor shall any person twice be put in jeopardy of life or limb for the same crime. So jeopardy of life, there's another one. And it says, nor shall any person be deprived of life without due process of law. So that's three textual references in the Fifth Amendment. And what the Fifth Amendment argument does is it takes those references and makes them into an argument against arguments against the constitutionality of the death penalty. So in other words, it's like an immunity, a defense against constitutional challenges. And it comes into at least two different forms, like sort of a strong version and then a somewhat weaker version. And the strong version is that these three references in the text of the Fifth Amendment mean that capital punishment must be constitutional. In other words, there's no way to constitutionally find that the death penalty is deficient. So in just as an example of this, in a 2008 case called Bays versus Rees, that was a challenge to the three-drug cocktail used in lethal injections, Justice Scalia said that the very text of the document recognizes that the death penalty is a permissible legislative choice. So he's talking about the Fifth Amendment there and saying it says that the death penalty is permissible. And it's not an argument that Justice Scalia invented. You see this as far back as Furman v. Georgia, which is really kind of the beginning of modern capital punishment jurisprudence. There, Chief Justice Berger said that the explicit language of the Constitution affirmatively acknowledges the legal power to impose capital punishment. So that's the strong version. It says you can't render this unconstitutional because the Fifth Amendment says it's okay. There's a slightly, say, weaker, more modest version, which is that the text of the Fifth Amendment shows that the framers believed that the death penalty was constitutional. And that also, that goes way back at least to Gregg v. Georgia, which along with Furman is sort of the foundation for modern jurisprudence on the death penalty. And there, the joint opinion for the court says, it's apparent from the text of the Constitution itself that the existence of capital punishment was accepted by the framers. So whichever of those two versions you go with, basically what the argument does is protect the death penalty against constitutional attack by saying the text of the Fifth Amendment shows that the Constitution, or at least the people who wrote it, approved of capital punishment.
So as you're outlining the stronger and the weaker versions of the Fifth Amendment argument, you go through the problematic logic of reading the Fifth Amendment as an implicit protection of capital punishment. And I'm wondering if you could explain that problematic logic with a little more specificity here.
Yeah, I'd be happy to. I think that the Fifth Amendment argument is deficient for a few reasons. And the big one is that the text of the Fifth Amendment that we just talked about contains prohibitions, not grants of government power. So it doesn't say that the government has some sort of inviolable background power to execute citizens. It just says that if and when such punishment is pursued, then the defendant gets certain protections like due process, presentment, and indictment, and so on. And what I don't like about the Fifth Amendment argument is that it basically flips all that around. It transforms those textual prohibitions into conditional grants of power. And I think you know, that kind of reasoning, frankly, would have been foreign to the people who wrote the Bill of Rights. You know, they were trying to limit government power, not increase it. And, you know, since you mentioned logic, I'll just say I don't think it works as a matter of logic. So anybody who's done formal logic or follows these sort of if statements will be familiar with why this is deficient. But it's basically the equivalent of converting the statement if not y, then not x into if y, then x. And just logically, the latter does not follow from the former. So that's just a matter of just parsing the text. But even if we read the Fifth Amendment as granting some kind of government power, which again, I don't think it does, it still wouldn't get you around other constitutional limitations, most prominently the Eighth Amendment's prohibition on cruel and unusual punishment. And so the Fifth Amendment argument wouldn't answer what are, in many of these prominent constitutional challenges, the relevant questions. Because, and I guess the reason for that is just that complying with one set of prohibitions doesn't give the government a license to violate other ones any more than, as I say in the article, if you're looking at the Ten Commandments instead of the Ten Amendments of the Bill of Rights, you know, if you decline to bear false witness against your neighbor, that doesn't give you a license to covet his or her spouse, right? That it just, they're separate prohibitions. So likewise, if you give a capital punishment due process, that doesn't mean you can then discriminate against them on the basis of race. Those are separate prohibitions. So I think complying with the Fifth Amendment doesn't give you any license to violate the Eighth. The only way for the Fifth Amendment argument to have any power would be to if the court first overturned its Eighth Amendment jurisprudence. Let me just say one quick word on that, because I think that is really what Justice Scalia, at least, was after with the Fifth Amendment argument. So the background there is that for decades now, when the court confronts an Eighth Amendment case, it asks whether a particular punishment is cruel and unusual, and it does that by focusing on what it calls evolving standards of decency that mark the progress of a maturing society. And if you're at all familiar with Justice Scalia's jurisprudence, you'd be unsurprised to hear that he hated this. He thought this was terrible. In fact, in a case called Glossop, which I think we'll talk about today, he said that the case that inaugurated that approach has caused more mischief to our jurisprudence, to our federal system, and to our society than any other that comes to mind. I think that's just extraordinary. It's just an extraordinary claim. But it's not something that the Fifth Amendment can really help you resolve. So in order for the Fifth Amendment argument to have any real power, the court would first have to overturn decades of its Eighth Amendment jurisprudence.
Well, let's turn to that Eighth Amendment jurisprudence, and specifically that Glossop case. Your piece features the Eighth Amendment line of cases quite prominently, and it seems like the Glossop case in particular at least provides a spark for your argument here. That Glossop case strikes me and many others, I expect, for the disagreement between Justices Scalia and Justice Breyer over Justice Breyer and Justice Ginsburg's dissent in that case.
Yeah, I think you put it exactly right there, Matt. It's the spark. That's why I ended up writing this article. But it's not, just as you say, it's not because of the holding in Glossop, which didn't actually change all that much in terms of doctrine. You know, it's the basic holding there is that a divided court held that this use of a particular drug called midazolam, I think it is, in lethal injections doesn't violate the Eighth Amendment. But the reason that it's such a noteworthy case is that exchange between Justice Scalia and Justices Breyer and Ginsburg over Justice Breyer's dissent. So Justice Breyer wrote this dissent, joined by Justice Ginsburg, in which he not only would have found in favor of the Eighth Amendment claim, but would have gone further. He identifies there what he calls three fundamental constitutional defects with the death penalty. Says that it's seriously unreliable, that it's arbitrarily applied, and that it's subject to these unconscionably long delays. And based on that, he wrote, again, joined by Justice Ginsburg, that the death penalty in and of itself now likely constitutes a legally prohibited cruel and unusual punishment. And that is, that's truly noteworthy, because it's the first time that two members of the current court have announced a belief that the death penalty is likely unconstitutional in and of itself. And so it's justifiably gotten a lot of attention. Now, as you suggest, Justice Scalia wasn't going to let that go. And so he wrote an opinion joined by Justice Thomas, which said that the dissent was full of gobbledygook, as typical sort of Scalia, and went on to say that not once in the history of the American Republic has this court ever suggested that the death penalty is categorically impermissible. And then here is where my ears started to prick up. He argued that the Fifth Amendment is the textual basis for capital punishment's continuing constitutionality. And this is just a quote from the opinion. He says, "The reason is obvious. It is impossible to hold unconstitutional that which the Constitution explicitly contemplates." That's basically just a statement of the Fifth Amendment argument that I'm arguing against. And in fact, when Justice Scalia announced his opinion from the bench, he took that step of announcing it from the bench, he said that he made that point even more strongly. He said that the death penalty is approved by the Constitution. So what we got in Glossop wasn't so much a significant holding about the Eighth Amendment, but really an enormously significant signal about the continuing constitutionality of the death penalty. And Justice Scalia's response invoking the Fifth Amendment is what, as you say, sparked me to write this piece.
So let's turn to Justice Scalia, but before we do, let's look at the originalist impulse guiding some of Justice Scalia's comments on capital punishment. And specifically in your piece, you have a fluency with the originalist methods of interpretation and its role in the capital punishment jurisprudence. So I'm hoping you can elaborate a bit for our listeners on the difference between what you term original meaning and original expected application. Tell us how those frameworks are relevant to your argument.
It's a great question, Matt. I mean, I think that the Fifth Amendment argument here, the one that I'm addressing, it's really always had a special appeal to people who self-identify as textualists and originalists. And I think the reason for that's pretty clear. I mean, it is at least built on the text of the Fifth Amendment. It has a nice kind of simplicity to it. In fact, long before Glossop, in his book on constitutional interpretation, Justice Scalia used the Fifth Amendment argument as his first example, I mean, his primary example for the fact that, or the point, the argument, that for an originalist, the vast majority of questions have clear answers. So it's sort of seen as a good example of how originalism can work. And there's something to that. Justice Powell said in Furman that, again, pointing to the Fifth Amendment, that there can't be the slightest doubt that the framers of the Constitution intended no absolute bar on the government's authority to impose the death penalty. So, on one respect, I think that's absolutely right. There is no doubt that the same people who proposed and ratified the Fifth and Eighth Amendments, including those references to the death penalty, also proposed and passed capital legislation. The death penalty was a fact of life in the colonies and in the early states. So I don't think there's any historical doubt about that. But the conclusions that you draw from that are can be different depending on sort of what brand or variety of originalism you subscribe to, if any. So it's one thing to think that the Fifth Amendment has an original meaning, something that was sort of etched into constitutional stone at the time of the framing. Like, it prohibits, for example, whatever punishments are found cruel and unusual according to the evolving standards of decency that mark a maturing society, for example. That's an original meaning. It might change over time. Just like you say, okay, the value of $5, that's an original meaning, but it could change over time. There's a difference, however, in trying to draw conclusions based on what the framers would have thought about questions that they confronted at the time. So for example, the fact that the framers themselves thought the death penalty was constitutional in the late 1700s doesn't necessarily translate directly into a conclusion that even under an originalist approach applies today, because that's all that says is that they had an original, what we would say, an original expected application of the Eighth Amendment, not necessarily an understanding of its original meaning that is limited. And most committed originalists tend not to focus explicitly or at least solely on original expectations. Again, that's what the framers thought about whether the Eighth Amendment prohibited capital punishment in the late 1700s. Instead, they tend to focus on what I was describing earlier as sort of the original meaning, that is, what the framers thought cruel and unusual punishment meant, which might someday extend to capital punishment. So to bring it all back to the Fifth Amendment argument, I think that the Fifth Amendment and its text, good evidence of original expectations, but that's not how most originalists do originalism, nor how most people do constitutional law, and it's definitely not how most people do the Eighth Amendment.
So because we've been talking about Justice Scalia and originalism so much, I have to ask you, how would Justice Scalia respond to your argument if he were sitting here?
I have no doubt that he would run circles around me rhetorically. I would hope that we could get him on the podcast. Maybe he'd publish a response. I think it's actually interesting that despite the fact that other justices, including Justices Brennan and Stevens, probably most prominently, had made some, you know, had essentially poked holes, I think, in the Fifth Amendment argument over the years, Justice Scalia never really answered them. And he kept making the argument, again, right up through Glossop, which was the last sort of opportunity he had to do it. And I'm not totally sure why that is. I think it might be that, you know, if he was cornered on this, he might say that it's just a rhetorical point, or maybe it's just a suggestion that the death penalty is constitutional sort of in principle, so long as it doesn't run afoul of other constitutional prohibitions. I don't think that would be particularly satisfying, though, partly because I don't think it really makes sense to talk about the death penalty in principle, like as if it were some kind of abstract thing that exists separately from the means of carrying it out. I also don't think that he was using it as simple rhetoric. I mean, when he, as I mentioned earlier, when he announced his opinion in Glossop, he said the death penalty is approved by the Constitution. That sounds to me like a legal conclusion, and if it's just rhetoric, then it should be abandoned. I mean, he often went after, you know, other justices or lawyers, for that matter, for sort of misleading rhetoric or flabby rhetoric and reasoning, and that sounds like it to me. I think, you know, in the end, his response would be to take the deal that I described earlier, which is to tear up the foundations of Eighth Amendment jurisprudence. I mean, I think what he might say is, yep, the Fifth Amendment is evidence that the court has been wrong all along about the Eighth Amendment, and so we've got to go clear that up by overturning that line of cases that starts with Tropp that looks to evolving standards of decency. And I think that was what was really, really bothering him. And maybe that's what he would say the Fifth Amendment argument is all about.
So turning away from the federal precedent here and turning away from the debates in that precedent over the constitutionality of capital punishment, let's look at the death penalty in practice more. And specifically, I've been looking at state Supreme Court opinions this past summer. In one, Connecticut, They cite your article as they strike down Connecticut's death penalty statute. Other states, Delaware among them, have taken similar steps. I noticed that the Delaware dissenters raised the Fifth Amendment argument. I also noticed that there was no challenge to it by the majority. But I'm curious, as I look at these state opinions, and Nebraska has been vocal. There's I believe it was a referendum a few years ago abolishing the death penalty there. Kansas has had movement, as have other states. So I'm wondering how you see your argument playing out in and influencing the continuing debate over capital punishment's constitutionality, maybe at the state level even more than the federal level.
That was a really nice, I think, summary of what the background is, Matt. I mean, I think by many measures, including some of the ones you stated about state courts, the movement to abolish capital punishment is gaining some steam. I'd add to that, you know, that wrongful convictions, botched executions, those continue to make headlines. Those bother people. It is also true that the death penalty is increasingly limited to a very small percentage, not just of states, but of counties across the nation. I mean, there are particular counties like Harris County in Texas, which execute more people than, you know, most states, almost any other state, I think, in the situation of Harris County. And then, of course, you've got the Glossop discussion we mentioned earlier, where two justices signaled that they think two sitting U.S. Supreme Court justices signaled that they think the capital punishment is, at least as practiced, unconstitutional. That really invites frontal challenges to the constitutionality of the death penalty, and we're already seeing some of those be filed. So where do I think that my article might fit into that? What I hope it does is prevent people from taking the easy way out by saying that the Fifth Amendment answers the inquiry, because it doesn't. You know, there may be very good reasons to say that the death penalty is constitutional, but you can't get there just based on the text of the Fifth Amendment. And I think sometimes the court, Supreme Court, and as you say, some lower courts have taken the easy way out just by pointing to that text as if it answers all the questions. You know, I mentioned earlier Bays v. Rees. That was a lethal injection challenge from 2008. And you know, in that case, Chief Justice Roberts set up the case, and essentially the way he set it up, decided it by saying that we begin with the principle that capital punishment is constitutional. It follows that there must be a means of carrying it out. Now, that's a really useful framing, a good sort of, you know, lawyerly move there. But of course, you have to ask, well, where do they get the principle that it's constitutional? And when you sort of follow the citations, it seems like what lies beneath that is the Fifth Amendment argument. And I just want to show in my article that that's not a good foundation. That's not enough. Now, you know, the background question in some respects is, you know, what will the court do? Will the court rule that the death penalty is unconstitutional? It's certainly been invited to a few months after Glossop. In fact, Justice Scalia said in an interview that he wouldn't be surprised if the court were to find the death penalty unconstitutional. I have to say, I'm not so sure about that, but whenever it does confront the question squarely, I hope it won't take the easy way out by invoking the Fifth Amendment argument.
Well, we only have a few minutes left here, Professor Blocher. And as we're talking about frontal challenges to the constitutionality of capital punishment, it strikes me that we might want to mention a recent development, and that is some Sixth Amendment challenges to capital punishment schemes. And I'm wondering if you could at all briefly discuss what role, if any, the Sixth Amendment plays in these debates over capital punishment's constitutionality.
Yeah, the Sixth Amendment has played a really prominent role in debates about the constitutionality of capital sentencing, especially in the last 15 years since the Supreme Court's opinion in a case called Ring versus Arizona. The reason I think it's so prominent right now was the court's holding last year in a case called Hearst versus Florida. And in that case, the court held that Florida's death penalty law violated the Constitution because it gave judges instead of juries the ultimate power to impose the death penalty. So that's the nub, really, of the Sixth Amendment challenges. You know, how much do juries have to have a say in, for example, what kind of aggravating factors have to be found, who finds them, and so on and so forth. Now, Hearst was not a close case. This is an 8-1 decision. Justice Alito, I think, was the only dissenter there. But the reason it's such a foundational challenge is that it turns out in some states, judges have a lot of authority over death sentences, more than I think most observers might think. And so Hearst has really opened an incredibly complicated set of questions about the imposition of death in systems like that. So you mentioned a moment ago the Delaware case. You know, in that case, Delaware's high court struck down its state death penalty on basically the same grounds as Hearst, on Sixth Amendment grounds. So, you know, along with these battles about whether capital punishment is cruel and unusual, for example, whether it violates in application the Equal Protection Clause, there's really been, as I say, especially over the last 15 years, a prominent set of cases challenging the way that certain capital sentencing schemes give authority to judges instead of juries. And it may be that one of those cases is what brings the death penalty back to the high court.
Well, Professor Blocher, with that, I'm afraid we're out of time. But I want to thank you for your time today. Thank you for this discussion. And we look forward to many more fruitful discussions of your article and looking at it cited in upcoming court cases.
Thank you so much, Matt. This is really a pleasure. It was a pleasure to work with you and the editors, and I look forward to seeing it in print.
Thank you very much. This has been an edition of the Northwestern Law Review Online's podcast. For more Northwestern Law Review Online publications, head to our website, northwesternlawreview.org/online.